waste your time's money in talking to people that doesn't matter. And we have one weird thing in Sweden that I will tell you about. It's if you work in Brazil, maybe not, but we have each summer, the second week of July, a big political meetup. This was Olof Palme, he was the Prime Minister of Sweden in the 60s and 70s. He started that, and he went to... Hey, welcome. He held a meeting in a park in an island outside Sweden, belongs to Sweden, and in the 60s. And then it's grown. So, it's called the Almedalen Week. And that's I just have to tell you about this. This is a small medieval city on an island where all the party leaders go this week. They have 1 week each, and 1 day each. Social Democratic Party, the Liberal Party, the Left Party, the Green Party. And then every lobbyist in Stockholm and all of Sweden flies there. Every NGO, all the major companies. So and there's no, you cannot wear a suit or tie. No. So everyone, you can meet the Prime Minister walking like in jeans and a t-shirt. And so of course, it's a very unique thing. I know the Baltics and some other countries in Norway tried to copy it, but this has been going on since the 60s. But it's a major influence because there you can just grab the state secretary of whatever, and you can say, yeah, I have this idea. And there's a very informal way of, and I mean, Sweden wants to be super transparent. I mean, the Prime Minister was ready in the 90s, he was biking to work, and then he took the subway, and it has, I mean, Sweden has a tradition of being a capitalist socialist country in some way. So it's not very much the elite and the, but it's, I mean, it's, of course it's there. So this is kind of it, but I just want to just mention this because it's kind of a unique thing. Maybe something that
is alcohol allowed.
Sorry?
Is alcohol allowed?
Yeah, it is. Alcohol is allowed. It is. It might be a social lubricant. discussions. But it's fun. It's sunny, it's summer, and it's politics. You can this go, this we call it a horse road. You see, it's a lot of people, it's a curb road. I've been in the industry for a long time. I can walk 3 meters, and it's like a big, class reunion here going on.
So, do you have speeches, or how do you...
Yeah,
how do you go, because you said there's a party
last year, it was 2,400 events, meetings. So, the mining association has one saying that why are mining with automatic is better than the other, and so there's a lot of that stuff. And then they will, thank you. Now, all the parties, political parties, has 1 day and one speech. So the party leader has a speech at 7, and then that's their day, so to speak. So some of them might not be there for the whole week, for a couple of days. Yeah, and then there's seminars going on, so many. But it's, I just wanted to, because that's an important hub in public affairs in Sweden. So, but when you have been there for a couple of years, I've been there many, many times, you kind of get tired of the little, I mean, Sweden, 10 million people, you kind of know all the faces. I don't know, I'm not saying I know 10 million, but it's the circles are kind of small. So, in 2006, we started to look outside of Sweden to see. Because Sweden is 10 million people. We are super dependent on exports. I mean, half of the GDP is import-export, and we have a long tradition of it. And our companies, I mean, the domestic market is so small, we have to look abroad. So even then as communication consultant, or career consultant, we thought, okay, what we now have done for the book associations and the airlines and so on, what can we do then in China, because China was, I mean, Germany is our biggest trade partner, and then Norway. China is only number seven, not as Brazil. I guess China is number one when it, in terms of export. But still, China is super important to Sweden. So I moved then. I was assigned to open up our Shanghai office, because in Western China, most of the headquarters were international companies' headquarters. And at this time, when I came, there were about 600 Swedish companies in China already in 2008. And now there's about 1,000 Swedish companies. And I looked for Brazil, it's around 100 or something like that. So not many. But I guess there is an explanation. But this, we were super lucky because we got an assignment 6 months after I came to Shanghai that we would take care of the Swedish pavilion at the World Expo in China in 2010. And Brazil was there, had a beautiful green pavilion, and even North Korea had a pavilion, so it was a lot of countries that had a pavilion. But it's kind of was a good thing for us to open up to see them, because there was a lot of Swedish companies then investing in this pavilion, wanting to meet Chinese clients and so on. So it was a good start. I just wanted to show you this picture because it was that was part of my life for a long time. This pavilion. So, starting up in China, we started to see what can we do here. I mean, we knew what we could do in Sweden, but let's see what we can do in China. But the thing was, if we wanted to compete with the the Chinese PR agencies and so on, that was cutthroat. I mean, we couldn't do that. There was no way we could make money competing with a Chinese company. But there was other interesting issues also. It was media relations in China works in a completely different thing. If this was, I did a lot of inaugural parties for Swedish companies and so on, where that required journalists. So we invited journalists. And then you could stand in the corner to look at the journalists coming, and they were coming in, and there was always a press kit lying neatly like that. And then you opened up you could see the journalists like opening up the press kit and doing like this. And then putting it down and leaving. Because they couldn't find a red envelope with the 200 renminbi, about 80 hairs. That was standard. And we didn't know that this. So we had actually a journalist looking through the press kit, didn't see the red envelope, and left. So, and we said, the Chinese said, that this is how you do it. It's taxi money. They said it was taxi money. I mean, that was a total lie. It was a total bribe for them to write something about it. And that was also hard for a Swedish company with high morals when it comes to transparency and so on. That, I mean, if we came out that Volvo or Scania bribed journalists in China, that could be a major issue. So we thought that we cannot do that. I mean, that was against our moral compass, and also it was. But the Chinese, they cracked down on corruption quite hard in China. But I mean, when everybody does it, it's hard then also, if you have a client, to not do it. I can understand my Chinese colleagues being the ones who didn't get any press coverage for your client.
It is interesting to know that, because it's very difficult to register a trademark in China. You have to prove the use of the trademark in the market. So how are you going to show that
if you don't have to publish
it?
Yes, absolutely. Then we found another thing that we could sell to our Swedish clients, and that was quite fun. We did that for a while, but that then became very complicated. We did it with a Chinese partner, but it was interesting because if you as a Swedish or an international company, you have a product you want to sell, okay, and it's named something. Say that. Take Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, for example. You would say that everyone would say Coca-Cola. But for Chinese, to Google a Coca-Cola, I mean, maybe a stupid example, But Coca-Cola, it's hard to Google, it's hard to ask someone for it, it's hard to have a discussion online about your product if you don't know how to spell it correctly. And the Chinese, they give everything a name directly. So first, they made up a lot of names for Coke when it actually entered, and it was a super strange name. But then, now it's Coca-Cola, I think it is. Larissa would know it better, she speaks better Chinese, but it means tasty and fun. So it has a name that resembles the original name, and it means something good. But they were super lucky. My clients were not so lucky when it came, because I work with steel companies, this is a Swedish steel company, but it just, what we did was actually give them new brand names so the Chinese could discuss them online, so you could talk about them and give them a certain meaning. So SSAT in Chinese, now I forgot it, was too long a time ago, but it meant something Swedish hard steel. Mm-hmm. But it has no resemblance to SSAB. No. This is just an abbreviation. And their best-selling products got new names that was powerful, but also show the heritage of Sweden and so on. So I think that was a good thing we did, when we named a lot of Swedish companies, gave them Chinese names, so now they can. And then also showing that they were part of China. Because if you don't, I mean, it's hard to take a wrong step. One famous example is Toyota Prado, a Japanese car that was introduced there in China. And in Chinese media, Prado sounds like, but it sounds like something in Chinese meaning heavy-handed, something like that. Do like this. So, and you know the relationship between Japan and China, then you have something like heavy-handed, and you have the Chinese lions bowing for a Japanese car. they have, Toyota have to take everything. I mean, they have to get rid of the ad campaigns and everything, and there was a crisis up to government level because of this. So there is no sensitivity at all. And that is something super important. Because I learned this the hard way in Sichuan province. I was working for a Swedish company called Bay Beyond. They make like carrying cots for kids, kind of high-end brand, and strollers and baby stuff. And for a Swede, this picture kind of is the essence of summer. I mean, we Swedes would love this picture, because this guy is on vacation. Now it's not very blue, but it should be blue. It's summer. It's the ocean. He's barefoot. He has his baby. I mean, this is kind of strikes a chord for every Swede. In this, we had a focus group, people like you, Chinese people, and there was one woman in the end saying, "I don't like this picture." Okay, why? It looks like this guy is looking for his shoes and looking for a job. I mean, that he was barefoot, that was a sign of total poverty for this to China. And he couldn't afford shoes. And then she saw he didn't shave, so of course he had no one to shave for. He must be on the floor. So they had to, and this in Sweden, that picture was in all the stores and all the magazines and everything. But we could not use that at all. So that is interesting. If you want your brand to be, sorry?
You have to understand the culture.
You have to understand the culture. Because it has to be, I found this quote that I really like. The trick in globalization is to strike the delicate balance between being mindlessly global, but at the same time helplessly local. And that's the big trick. And that is what I think is super interesting. It has to do not only with creating, I mean, glossy pictures or anything, it also has to do with relationships, to have the local relationship with the plant, the local politicians in the area, you have the plant, etc., etc. You have to actually show that you focus on China problems, or you can actually be, you have to be in China for China, as we talk about later. So I think globalization is here to stay. And to be a global player also means that you have to go local. It doesn't have to be that everyone in China would buy a Brazilian or a Swedish or American product because it's global, it's there. It has to have adaptation, it has to be fit into the local context. And then it also has to do with hiring local people. It has to do with if you're a research company, if you're having an R&D in your company, to actually focus on AstraZeneca, a Swedish. I have mostly Swedish example. I'm sorry, I'm not bragging about Sweden, but they did a lot of. There was a pharmaceutical company. They did a lot of research when they entered China in diseases that were predominantly affecting Chinese people. So that got them really, that if Pfizer did not do that, or the other ones, GlaxoSmithKline, maybe didn't do that. That was a key asset to them. And also to adapt your product to locally. I mean, this famous example of Häagen-Dazs that has the green tea flavor in China, because green tea flavor is everywhere. Samsung did a great job in India doing a washing machine that did not kind of reset when there was a power shortage. I mean, in rural India, there's a lot of power, so it kind of, when the power came back, it could continue, etc., etc. So there's a lot of great ideas. They sold detergent in small one size because people could not afford it, so they want to wash one time. I mean, to actually understand the local market, to understand the local needs, that is. I mean, super key. And I was thinking in the car over here, I mean, we are so small. I mean, Brazil is a superpower. Sweden is a tiny, tiny country. Maybe it could be that we're quite good at actually being good at listening more than acting, or kind of being prone to adapt to what is needed locally. I don't know, because I mean, a lot of companies do that as well. But it's interesting to see, because I think it's I think Swedish companies have been quite successful in adapting products and so on and building relationships. So I'm looking at my notes so I don't miss anything. Yes, but also very important. China is a one-party system. It's a dictatorship. I mean, we we cannot face it. There's a lot of other countries with values that doesn't at all correlate with your own moral values. I mean, it could be also cultural differences that are super big. And I think this is something you have to, I mean, we have been in Sweden, in some media being blamed for being, you're running the dictatorships. And I think my own answer is always that trade kind of opens up relationships between people, okay? That if there's trade, there is ongoing conversations, and hopefully, not naturally, it can lead to an increase. I mean, China has they called it the so-called human rights, and you know, the press, there's so much awful things going on in China. However, I think, I'm not pro-boycott. I think actually that discussions make. Now China's kind of going, sadly, in the other direction, but I still believe that the trade and relationships are much more inferior to just not doing business. Because then there's always other countries. I mean, there's a lot of African countries and other countries that doesn't care about human rights or press, freedom of press or anything. They will just do the business. Maybe it's better that we, the democracies, do it instead. I don't know. So, but there's a lot of pressure. I mean, the Prime Minister of Sweden, every time he goes to China, he has to actually say something. Because otherwise it would be stupid, I mean, to not ever comment on it. So we've been lucky in that sense that we had a long relationship with China. This is the East Indiaman. This is a newly built ship of a ship that sailed between Sweden and China between 1731 and 1813 in trading with China. So trade always started about 300 years ago with China. And Ericsson, that was in this picture, this is Ericsson, the telecommunications company, the Swedish company, that sold their first switchboard to China in 1891. So this is a super old picture. And that is very good, because that we have used a lot, of course. And we were the first Western country to establish official diplomatic relations with China. Because that shows that there is a special bond. But maybe also we have learned something along the way to do business with the Chinese. So then, some of our clients, but also some of the Swedish, because Sweden is small, we have to do a lot of trade, but also it has been that a lot of some people call Sweden the small country with the large companies, and that is I think that is true, but the export is humble compared to China, but there's a lot of companies on site, so there's a lot of experience in trading and doing business with the Chinese. I think a lot of these people then realized, like 5-10 years ago, that you cannot just say you're a global company and just say it and don't have a management team that reflects it, a presence. One of my colleagues, 5 years ago, she was here in Sao Paulo helping one of our clients, but just not working on Brazilian soil, but she was there. And then the communications director was presenting the new management team to the Brazilian workforce. They have 5% of the workforce here in Brazil. And then she was really proud of this presentation she was doing for the staff, and she showed the management team, and they were all Swedes. Yeah. And one of the Brazilians said, okay, you say you're a truly global company, but only see Swedes there. And another said that, but at best, we are then an exporting company with some presence in foreign countries. And that I think is something that has changed gradually. That people, you see now management teams in large multinationals, they are not only from the country where they originated, because they have to reflect a global company. Atlas Copco, a Swedish mining company, they actually moved their whole R&D department and one mining and technology department to China, and they had to do that. I don't know, that might help, but I mean, that's one part of it.
So what's the perspective from these companies on intellectual property, for example? Because when you hire, let's say a Swedish company goes to China, hire local engineers and so on. So we see that in China, they usually build up some local company that in like 5-10 years starts to compete with these companies, right?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because that's really has been the flip side. In like 10-15 years ago, you heard that all the time. You heard like, oh, there's a new SSAB, the steel company, selling, having built up a plant just next to it and copying everything. And that, I guess that's still happening. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly how you protect yourself in the best way to do that. The only thing I can say is that it hasn't been a decrease in companies establishing themselves in China, but maybe they are more careful with their intellectual property. And maybe you cannot protect yourself if you have an employee that says, I'm out of here, and I go. I mean, it's hard to do it. Of course, you can legally get this person to the environment, but I guess maybe also you have to create an environment that you actually want to stay in this company. Because that goes up and down. Before, it was super cool to work for a foreign company in China for the Chinese. It was really something new. You want to work for Apple or Google or anything. But then, kind of the red carpet for foreign investment has been rolled back. The tax cuts and everything, and the kind of economic protectionism has risen, and more proudly to be Chinese. So now it's not that cool anymore. So I guess I think China now wants to create their own superheroes, not only copying the Western companies anymore. To actually, I don't know, can you name a super brand from China?
Alibaba.
Huawei.
Huawei.
Yeah.
Somebody
else.
Huawei.
Yeah. I mean, sorry.
No.
No. Because that's, I mean, that's part of the plan to actually become, to create more. You have new Xiaomi, the new cell phone operator that only sells online and so on. So they are putting a lot of research efforts into actually create their own super brand, because kids want to not join the American management consultancies and other technology companies. So, but exactly how you best protect yourself from intellectual properties theft, I don't know. I think it's now.
I think that's the reason why Google and other global TI enterprises don't establish RD in China, only the manufacturing part.
But within the manufacturing part is already locally produced in China, right?
Yeah,
it is. However,
but
I mean,
softwares.
Yeah. Yeah, inside the manufacturer.
Okay.
But I mean, if you are truly keen on taking on the Chinese market, then it's hard to not have your R&D in China, to not target your products to the Chinese audience. So I mean, it's a double. It's tricky exactly how to do that. As I said before, this is ADB, another industrial company, having a famous tagline called In China for China. That's what they said all the time, and they've been kind of a textbook example of a good, I mean, it's just a tagline, but it kind of shows their commitment to China. And it then excelled into for China and Liyue, because of course somebody in the beginning just wants to sell to Chinese people, a Chinese market, but then Chinese market going. So I think then the trick is then for ABB or for any other company to actually show how do you fit. This is a Sandvik a drill, and this is Sany Chinese. And for the same price, you buy one of these, you get three of these. And that's of course the trick. If you want to convince someone saying, okay, you can get one from me, but you can get three for the guy across the street. So, and I think that's super tricky. I don't know exactly, I mean, we're coming from the more of the premium, the Swedish companies are coming from the more premium sector, but to convince someone to buy something like this instead of that's the trick. And that's actually, you have to answer the question, are you relevant in the Chinese market? If you have to convince the Chinese, of course, that might hold for 15 years, and these hold for 5 years each. I mean, it could be same, but that should be, I mean, if someone should buy it, it should be hold, I mean, last for 30 years instead of 5 years each. So I think that's the trick. And what we've seen lately is that people actually have to move down from the premium segment, because it's very crowded up there with all the brands from all over the world wants to sell to the Chinese. And maybe the volume are not too big. So what we see lately is a shift downwards, that you have to adapt your product. You have to go to this mid-market, maybe not down to the value market, because this is really cutthroat environment, but maybe here. But then you see the level of adaptation has to increase the lower you get, because then you compete with more local players and so on. And you cannot say that I sell the Scania, I have the BMWs and everything, and we don't change anything. But then in the mid-market. And that's a kind of fairly new, before 10 years ago, no companies, the big ones, didn't talk about adaptation in that sense to actually have less configuration, cheaper car models, and so on. But now you see that a whole lot. So to change your product, you have to communicate about the product. And I took this picture at IKEA. Are you familiar with IKEA, the furniture store?
Yeah.
And I mean, China eats the most garlic in the world. But still, they needed to actually show how you use a garlic press. And I think that's an interesting essence of actually saying that we cannot come to Western values and Western way of doing things and saying the whole world should do it the same way. I mean, maybe they don't sell it anymore, I don't know. But this is how we have to communicate to do that. So if you then ask companies like IKEA and the other companies we talked about, what are the key success factors of doing business? This is quite old, I think. It's, yes, yeah, I'm sorry. But yeah, so this might have shifted around. But I just wanted to show you that relationships are still, I mean, relationships and networks, you have the quality of the management team, of course, and company brand and so on. But I mean, the soft values, like relationship, what you're talking about, influencing and talking to people, knowledge of relevant laws and regulations for lawyers and support for government, that is also key issues, but also causing the most difficulties is unclear, changing inconsistent law, stricter and more difficult regulations to fulfill, local professional services not up to necessary standards, and unfair advantage of Chinese competitors by governments and so on. So these are issues for external Brazilian and Swedish and I guess all companies entering China. That there are this one has been at the top for a long time, but I mean might be going down. So just to sum up, why invest then in government relations, public affairs in China? I think this is a quote, but I think it's it's interesting. The last row: if China decides all screwdrivers are 7 centimeters long, sooner or later all screwdrivers are going to be 17 centimeters long. So it kind of shows the impact of China. I don't know if this is actually true about that, but it shows that the kind of sleeping dragon China is now one of the nodes in the world, together with Brussels and Washington, Sao Paulo. That Beijing is dictating the terms. This I can send you this presentation later. Of course, yeah. You don't have to bootleg it. Because I think next slide is a lot of text. I won't go through this right now, but you can really read this kind of the development as we see it of public affairs in China, going from using the princings, I will talk about them a bit later, changing times where it was just happy-go-lucky for foreign companies in the beginning, but then the carpet was rolling back. And what does that mean to actually embed a public affairs function in the companies and to create a new government affairs framework? Because what everyone says, I've heard this for many times, and if you hear this in Brazil, if you have a Swedish company coming into Brazil, and you start to meet some guy in a restaurant and so on, and say, I know this guy, I know, he knows everyone, he's super well connected, you should ask him. And you have these guys in Madrid, you have them in Prague, you have them in Stockholm, you have them everywhere. In China, they used to be called the princelings. It was the kind of sons, and mostly the sons, of politicians and so on. And so many companies have actually had real problems with kind of trusting these princelings to manage the super important public affairs function. So, I everyone said, no, you see, China is different. I know exactly how to do it. So, these guys, that guy who knows everything, it's very hard to build a public affairs strategy around some guy you who just says to you. And there's you cannot build anything on them. So I think you have to institutionalize in the organization the public affairs function. And I mean, if someone says, I don't need to know all the details related to how we work with political contacts, and that has a lot of HQs said, we don't know exactly how they do it, but they will have it done. I mean, that's really a start of a really interesting discussion. And if people say then, we have a strong relationship with the local government, they will help us expand our business in China. Yes, that's very good. They might be very welcoming, they might be opening up and their networks and so on, but in the long run, they will not be the supporter of your business. They would be, they are the local, they would be the supporter of that area, and if you're not there, they might not care less. So it will not substitute a market, the relationship. So that has to be taken with a grain of salt. We cannot work in government affairs in China. It's not. We talked about this before, and I think yeah, that's fair. You can say that. However, that's not really. I mean, we have government affairs is both reactive and proactive. You can, something happen, you have no clue about it, you have to have a position on it. Either you want it or not, you're affected by it. But also there's a lot of, like here in Brazil, there's a lot of institutions, democratic institutions working, like the chambers. And the chambers are really, I mean, they are a super great entity to actually know what is going on. And I mean, then you're kind of in China, but you have you get the knowledge from their expertise and the party also, of course, is you have a lot of people in the party. Somebody you can actually meet someone and create a relationship to know what's going on. You don't have to say that everyone is the evil because they represent China. If you're coming from that side, you can actually have a reasoning on what is going on and how that might affect you. So to sum up, I won't bore you maybe with a lot of cases. We have been working with a pulp and paper mill, one of the largest investment, the Nordic investment in China ever. It was $900 million. But the thing was we were hired because we needed, and I have to say something first that I didn't say before. Our staff is not very big. I mean, we have a couple of people, but we have super senior people on site in both Beijing and Shanghai. And I think one thing that has to be totally clear is that you need to find a great partner to work with. To have someone, we have actually, that has been tricky because you start to work with one partner, you think they are great and they resemble you, like Larissa and her company. I'm not saying, but you compare, you meet and so on. And then it turned out to not be true. So that's not super easy to find someone. We're lucky to find a company that can actually be our ears and that we represent the client, we create the strategy. But there's a lot of work that we have to do in Beihai with the paper mill to go around to meet all the local politicians to say what are the concerns here? Because we have to move, we have to move people. Have to move villages and so on, and that's always, I mean, that has to be time. I mean, you have to have silk gloves on doing that. So that's what we got this assignment to actually make everyone happy. But to have a great partner. And also, we now work with a large Swedish furniture company, as we call it here in code. And this is the Chinese wanted to be best in class to set a new industry standard for something called volatile organic compounds, and they put the standards super high, so there was a barrier to all foreign companies. But the thing was that they really didn't have to do that scientifically. I mean, it was not, they just wanted to show that we are best in class. So the European Furniture Association took China to the WTO, and there was a big discussion. But one key takeaway then, if we can go to the critical success factors, is that to deal with, you cannot be, I'm not being prejudiced to the Americans, but the Americans kind of have a tough standard when it comes to my lawyer says that, and the lawyer says that, and there's a, like we did with a house contract now in DC. That doesn't work in China. I think our success in the furniture case was to have the soft approach, to have the dialogue approach, and to share the knowledge. We could put our guy from our client together. We found a technical committee with a guy who was actually in charge of this setting the standard, and they started a discussion, and that discussion grew. And we could actually share a lot of knowledge to the Chinese, which actually helped them now to set the standard at a fairly at a reasonable level, so it was not a trade barrier to foreign companies. And that is the that is actually what is my, I mean, the key lesson, to create win-win situations, to share knowledge. And you can say share knowledge, and people can say, but you don't share technical secrets. I mean, you don't share business strategy, etc. But you share to create a win-win situation. That has helped us. We have done, like, I think 6 or 7 kind of major public affairs projects in China. And I think all of them sums down to actually see, okay, what can we give you? What can you give us? And I mean, it's like a negotiation, but not have the tough, that doesn't work in India, that's work in Southeast Asia, to have the tough stance against the Chinese, because then everything shuts down. It doesn't work. So I think that is, to offering clients competence and knowledge in order to educate government. Because, I mean, China has fairly newly entered. It could be, we have this, one problem now in Sweden with oat. Oat has to be stored in China with a maximum of 10% moist, or moist, what is it called?
Moist,
yeah. And in Sweden it's 40%. And I mean, if you want to be best in class, you put like 10%. But scientifically, there's no, I mean, it could be 20%. It could be, I mean, but they said that. So I think that is that discussion. There's a lot of stuff you can do if you find the trade barriers, or you find that you can have a discussion. That is absolutely our most important takeaway. And maybe it's general, and maybe it's not rocket science, but that really. That tough approach does not work at all. We have negative experience of that. So yeah, I will send you this presentation, because some of the slides were a lot of work. But I think to make China your second home is super important to understand what's going on. I think to be able to do business locally, you have to engage locally to understand. You don't have to be the one who speaks Chinese the most perfect, etc. I was definitely not the one, but I could do it with a humility, with a humbleness, and that has been the key success for us to do business in China. Because it's super interesting, it's a fascinating market. It's getting tougher and tougher. It really is. And it's interesting to see. I mean, I know that you export a lot of soybeans to China. You have a large trade relations with China, but you don't see so many of, I looked at the timeline, the first Brazilian bank came in the 70s and so on. But I mean, there's an infrastructure, I guess, because first come the big companies, like Vale, and now of course the big ones are first, and then comes the banks, but then comes the service providers, then comes the lawyers, and the PR agencies, and lobbying companies, etc., helping out the large ones. But yeah, I don't know, maybe nothing what I've said is useful, but maybe just interesting to hear how we have done it, and it's not something you can actually do something about, but yeah. This is, of course, if someone wants to discuss this further, I'm all ears, and I don't know, I think it's actually, thank you for me.
Well, thank you so much, Henrik. at least for me, it was mind-opening. I'm sure it's enlightening for many people here too. Not very familiar with the China market at all, so it was great to hear from you. We hear a lot of how important it is to get to know the culture and to engage and, as you said, to be humble. So, and of course, as you said, we Brazil, again, says, well, Brazil is a large market and has a tougher time in acknowledging sweetness, the relevance of going abroad and importance of that because of the consumer market we have. But we have the first steps, we have the big ones there,
yeah.
So it makes sense. And of course, there are the challenges, everything you said about not being a democratic country, but I think it was very useful the way you put out how we can stick to our values and find ways to work with other entities, with right the chambers or in a reactive way, and how important it still is to be there and to work on that front. And I was wondering if you think the having lived for 3 years in Brazil, we tend to think ourselves as very, very open to different styles, different culture, and more humble than what you said, for instance, about the Americans. Do you think that this part of Brazilian culture would make sense in China? We would have a chance to succeed because we tend to be more open and looking forward to a win-win situation.
Yeah.
Do you have that feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that I cannot speak for all. It's maybe stupid to base my opinion on just the people I met, but I really think so. I think that the Brazilian way of doing business and being prone to find win-win solutions and being friendly and a genuine population, I think that is important. I'm not saying then that all Americans are this way, it's tricky. I don't want to offend anyone, but I think that to actually be, because I mean don't forget that China sees themselves as the real superpower. I mean they are, but at the same time, they just entered the market economy quite recently. So it's a double. I mean, being a giant, but also being kind of new to facing the rest of the world. So it's a double sword in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So, would you like to make some comments, questions? To open
but you're all students. Sorry, I'm not. You're students.
Yes, we are students from the Catholic University of Brazil,
mm-hmm.
And we work with a little project called Workshop at UCB.
Yeah,
it's a workshop.
Yeah.
As you can think, it's about intergovernmental relations.
Yeah.
And this year we are talking about advocacy and diplomatic.
Comparative
diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know, working with this idea and invite some people to talk about this in our event. We're going to be in the second semester of this year.
Yeah.
And
in September,
exactly.
Okay.
September, in 24th September.
Yeah.
And we hopefully use this meeting to
acquire some knowledge.
Yeah, to acquire some knowledge. Yeah.
I will send you, I don't know where to send it. I just got your professor's, maybe I can send it to him. We wrote a book 3 years ago called Trust and Transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. I can send it, it's hard to send it from, I just have one book here, but I can send it as a PDF maybe.
Yes, of course. I will put your work here.
And
send it to us.
Okay, oh great.
Thank you.
To all the cards I got here, I will maybe
I'll give you my card.
And
you can send to the context in the list.
Sure. There's a list. Oh, there's a list here. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
If everyone put their mail, we can send.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's not very. We wrote a couple of chapters each, but it kind of sums down some of the stuff I'm talking about. Not so much about. It's not techniques in lobbying. How to do this and don't do that and so. Mm-hmm. Kind of more of the worldview on how to make the most of globalization for the clients and so on. So that maybe it could be interesting to read.
I think it would be because everyone here and from the university is starting to learn about this area. Most of it is falling in love with this. It's going to be powerful to
it's super interesting. I mean, what an adventure it is. I mean, in the past, if you wanted to live abroad, maybe you could be you were a diplomat. That was one way of growing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, diplomacy is not really booming, becoming bigger, so rather the other way around.
Yes.
Fewer embassies and so on. But I mean, to actually take a work for a company in another market and make it kind of part of the business environment, I think it's so interesting. And I've been lucky. I mean, with a lot of companies coming, we want to sell this in China, and to start, it's like a. I mean, yes, like a lawyer works. It's like a mystery. How do you solve this in the best way? And there's a lot of stuff written about it. But I mean, maybe it's just you have to invent something yourself. I think that this is it's international business and the effects of globalization. How do you make use of it? I think that's interesting.
So, Henrik, in Brazil, we usually study the history of China's development in the last two or three decades as a history of success, right?
Yeah.
And here in Brazil, we usually, one of the challenges is Asia, broadly speaking, right? And one of the keys to the success, from what I see, is how they manage to attract big companies, technology companies, and again, not only by breaking the intellectual property, but by making some joint ventures and this kind of stuff. And this kind of regulations that China has for foreign companies, we don't see here, right? So what's the role of
the regulations?
This kind of regulations for transfer of technology and the logos, the brands.
Yeah.
We don't see it here. Right? So what do you think could be like a good path for Brazil to attract these multinationals of high technology, and we create our own superheroes, as you mentioned, right? So you said that China wants to create their own superheroes,
yeah,
right? And in Brazil, looking from a developing country perspective, we don't find it here, right? So Southeast Asia's path of development, and Latin America path of underdevelopment, always underdevelopment, right? So what would you say that is the secret or the magic that happened in East Asia and China that attracted many foreign firms, and they managed to create their own superheroes, even though they had to bring these firms?
Yeah.
Or in terms of, I don't know, regulations.
I mean, for China, it was kind of as a communist country, Deng Xiaoping said, somebody has to get rich first. I mean, and he had some more poetic languages and so on.
Mm.
So again, they opening up, I think, was a strategic decision, in that sense, and I think there was a lot of stuff that coincided with being having a skilled workforce,
yeah,
a super skilled workforce. But I think, I don't want to be... I'm not expert in Brazil and Latin America, so I can compare it, but I think what they first looked after was the big investment of the heavy industry, because that's what they were used to, and that's what the communist country understands. And that's a bit what I hear from Latin America too. We want to attract the large foreign investments in heavy infrastructure, in heavy industry. And I really don't think the future is in that sector. I would be, I mean, for Brazil's sake and for Latin America, I think the interesting thing is has come, if you compare it to other, I mean, Google or I mean, all the tech industries that have become major players, they didn't come from steel or so on. So I think, but it's hard to just take one lesson. I mean, of course, it's political that you lower company tax. You say that you don't have to pay company tax for 5 years or do like that, and you kind of take your opening up investment offices in Europe, saying invest in China and so on. But of course now China is getting more expensive for companies, and then it moves on to Vietnam, and then it goes to Africa and so on, kind of walks around. But well, yeah, if I had the solution, I would.
A professor in China, I heard class from him, and he said that it's terrible to be exploited by someone, but it's even worse not to be exploited by anyone.
Yeah.
So it's better to be included in this the chain of, you know, of production, but you start somewhere, right?
Yeah, but then of course after a while you get enough, as China has now. We don't see any tax cuts or anything. Now it's more of a leveled playing field. And I guess, of course, they acquired a lot of knowledge from Western companies. Let's be clear about that. I mean, they've been stealing a lot. That's the case. And now they want to have their own superheroes. Now it's not so easy anymore for the top American or European companies to get the super Chinese, the super talent. They'd rather go work for Alibaba or the other companies. So now it's more even in that sense, and tougher.
And they're competing with American and European companies in the global south, right? In Africa and in Latin America, right?
Exactly. But also what China does, when they go abroad, is to actually finance infrastructure.
Yeah.
That's their thing to do. I mean, there's been talk about the railroad here in Latin America financed by China. Because I mean this huge country needs all the natural resources it can get, so it doesn't fit all their resources within the country limits, so they have to go abroad. So, but I think it's hard to say. I will not say you should do this and that. I think you just have to be on site in China to learn how to listen, maybe in the beginning more than talk. And not now really be, now there's so many, there's so many stories, there's so many examples, so many cases. I mean, if you look at McKinsey Quarterly and the big management consultancies case studies, there's so much knowledge now about China. So I mean, you can go there with open eyes and not be afraid of actually making relationship and doing actually public affairs that you've done in Brazil to translate it, if you find a good partner. I mean, that is to have someone to work with. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
It took you a little bit longer.
Thank
than,
you
yeah,
so much.
And you can have
more,
yeah.
We have some snacks and some more coffee here.
Mm-hmm. I'm in no hurry.
Thank you.
It's just...
Yeah.